Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail bro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black on black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit won't be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail bro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, yeah, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, nbpp.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Holler if you hear me. Yeah. Here we go, turn it up, let's start. From block to block, the sad heart, the Jack and Mark. And the punk police can't fake the emergency. We can have big some safety. But right now I got my mind set up. Looking down the bottle, I'm a gun, get up. Cause it's time to make the payback back to my brothers on the block. Better stay strapped, black, and accept no substitutes. I bring troops to the youth, tear a roof over the whole school. Until then, rage.
turn this motherfucking shit up.
Down. for you, bro. Daddy ready? Everybody in there?
Attention, all soldiers, come gather formation. My African warriors to my thugs and gangsters. It's time to fight hard, cause our life is in danger. Stop practicing on each other and get the one that's a gangster. It's time to link up and form one big army. Unite all of our numbers, get them people up off us. This whole thing designed to get you broke or you locked up. But we gon' tear it down because this world belongs to us. I say, Lord, we can step ripping for the dust. We can see death in line. You got nine, love yourself. Yes, a queen, seven people, yes, a savior. What if you don't know your culture, come and let me activate you. Circulate the black dot, keep the black dot of black. We were taught by master not to have each other back. Now we linking with each other, help each other stack, stack. Black pride, one nation, strong and black. That's what's down, see that job that you seek, it ain't all that it seems. They tryna really let your black Wall Street dream. You gon' make it all happen like a king and a queen. But when you rep the culture, it ain't hard as it seems. We gon' march like Martin by the window like X. We gon' free our people by enemies next. Since the last week, we know Omega showed us that we're royalty. And garments stack the bread and bars of boats to set us free. When I see noise, what the step, ripping, come to the devil. What the scene, pass the lies, you got lies, you just suck. You're the king, you're the queen, you're the people, you're the rock. Alcohol to the hood, they want you to sell dope, kill and rob for your food. But they ain't bring no jobs, so people dying for the food. It's Operation Us and we gon' operate on us. When I say march, you say step, rep and come to the death. You can see past they lies, you got knowledge yourself. Use a king, use a queen, to your people, use a savior. If you don't know your culture, come and let me activate ya.
Understanding the very origin and the nature and the coding of the white man, and understanding that his very existence and world control and domination and the maintaining of white supremacy is based on the murder of the black man and woman, then it is no wonder that police brutality is to the level that it is in black communities all over America. The cold-blooded murder of Brother Aswan there in Brooklyn just a few weeks, months ago, shot 20 times, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26 times. Brother Jerry Lee Amy in Los Angeles, shot 39 times, over 6 feet tall, shot even on his shoulders, which meant, did the cracker get on a stepladder and shoot him on his shoulders, or did they shoot him and shoot him and shoot him down to the ground and keep shooting him even after he was on the ground? You don't have to shoot a damn elephant 39 times to kill an elephant. And Jerry Lee Amy, as always, as all of us are, was the wrong man. Cracker was looking for a robbery suspect. Jerry Lee Amy is playing with his daughter in the front yard. And as they are running across the front yard, the cracker assumes that he is a so-called fugitive of Just Us. And so they shoot him down on his lawn in front of his baby girl. Brother Philip Pinnell would still be alive in New Jersey. Brother Lewis there in St. Petersburg, Florida, would still be alive as the crackers rolled up on him and claimed that his car lunged forward, that one was on the side and the other one, what kind of fool this is, I don't know. The other cop was supposedly in front of the car looking through the front of the windshield. Common sense would tell a damn fool, you don't have to be a policeman, that you don't stand in front of the vehicle. But they claimed the vehicle lunged forward. They shot him. The policeman was never hit by the vehicle. The vehicle never crashed anywhere into the pole or anywhere on the side. Brother Lewis would still be alive if we understood this dynamic better than we understand it. Our brother in Johnny Gamage in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who was there in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, and the crackers said that he stepped on his brakes and his brake lights came on too many times. His brake lights were blinking too many times. And so they snatched him from the vehicle, and all of them jumped on top of him and beat him and choked him and choked him until they choked in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Brother Johnny Gamage to death, Sister Eula May Love, and the many that are from the New York area, from the New Jersey area, from Chicago, from Los Angeles, from the South, and throughout. All of them, brothers and sisters, victims of police brutality, and we don't even have the time to name all of us killed at the hands of brute beast police. It was former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall who spoke at Howard Jew University, sometimes called Howard University. And as he spoke there, he said that the Ku Klux Klan, that the white paramilitary right-wing organizations, the Nazis and others, that the Klan no longer just wears white hoods and white sheets, but now the Klan wears blue uniforms, carries a badge or a shield and a legal, quote-unquote, weapon, that the Klan now wears black robes and sits on the judge's bench to rule from the courtroom. And so Thurgood Marshall, having been a Supreme Court justice, too afraid to make bold stands himself, but in a sense like the spook who sat by the door, on his way out, he could begin to give up a little bit of the truth. And right here in New York, we have Judge Bruce Wright. And as we read his book, Black Robes, White Jesters, in Black Robes, White Jesters, Judge Bruce Wright gives us the inside track on the criminal justice system of the white man. And never call it a criminal justice system unless you put the adjective in front of it, that it is a criminal justice system. In fact, it is the criminal justice system. It is no wonder that there is police brutality, because the white man is a criminal. He's the number one criminal on the face of the planet Earth. Criminals established the criminal justice system of white America. Every law in the penal code system of the state of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, California, Georgia, no matter where, and the penal code for the federal government of the United States of America, every law in the penal code book, every law was broken by the white man in order to establish that state, to establish this state, and to establish what he calls the United States of America. Every law. Some of you saw us on Harold Hope. That's what he is. That's a little Ebonics. I can't call him Harold Hoare. Ebonically speaking, he's Harold Hope.
I hear the million Youth Family March now is going to be for all races, all colors, and they're going to have a mass marriage, interracial marriage. Anybody that's out there, if you're in the crowd, if you're getting married, hell, you're going to get married. Sisters going to get married to devil men. Huh? But I mean, it shouldn't be under the voice of a conscious and righteous occasion. Say they doing that now. Brothers will get married to white women. Whoever is in the crowd gets married. And not only will sisters get married to white men, but some sisters will get married to white women. And some brothers will get married to white men. Did I say sisters with white women? Brothers with white men, whoever's getting married gets married. Then an integrated homosexual couple will go out saying, I got married at the Million Family March. What happened to the voice of Elijah Muhammad? What happened to Elijah? Elijah taught you, black man and black woman, that the very elect of God would be deceived. That the dragon would sweep up a third of the stars of heaven with his tail. and that the very elect
rise in a way to support the dominant system, and in this instance to support white domination. So it becomes very important that whatever we talk about it in context, because the major ruse that is used in the academies is to decontextualize subject matter. That is to take subject matter out of context and to project it as race neutral and objective. So as a matter of fact, when you read your newspapers, you will see the same kind of game going on. You will get discussions of black on black violence, the homicide among our young men, and you will get half explanations or half truths, such as these young men are killing each other because of the availability of guns. You know, somehow it's just the mere availability of guns that's causing black on black homicide, or just the selling of drugs, or other half explanations. We have to watch out for that, because often the other half is the most important one, the one that is left out. How are the guns distributed? Who manufactures them? Who sells them? And the whole bit. Who imports the drugs? Who distributes the drugs? Or it's the cause of poverty. Crime is caused by poverty, caused by poor family background. We get a whole plethora of these kind of half-truth definitions. These guns are made available within a social political context. Drugs are made available within a social political context. Families are broken apart within a social political context. Poverty is created within a social political context. Poor education is the result of a social political context, ladies and gentlemen. And we must constantly then look at that context and see how it creates the conditions of which we complain so much. We must then recognize, as we begin to look at black upon black violence, we must see that violence and its connections to a racist society. And we must come to understand what a racist society is about. We use that term so often without analyzing it very well. And we must recognize essentially then that a racist society is about structuring social and political, economic circumstances, psychological and cultural circumstances, such that one race can take advantage of another, and one race can enhance itself at the expense of another. It has little to do with overt race hatred or with negative racial attitudes or with the projection of racial stereotypes or, as Brother Harris says, with whites not understanding the nature of their racism. That's not it. And when you define it in terms of attitudes, you'll find yourself then solving the wrong problems. These people will stop expressing those negative attitudes, you see. They will smile more regularly at you. They will even marry you and go to bed with you, sleep with you. But you will note that the effects of racism, the effects of poverty and all of these other things will continue. But not only do they continue, they increase. Ultimately, you must recognize that racism involves the power of one race to impose its will upon another. That ultimately then it is about power, and we have to face that fact. Whites engage in racism because they have the power to do so. And if we are to end white racism, then we must end white power. We use the word imperialistic society and imperialism often, also without looking at it very deeply. and looking at the term very deeply. Imperialism of empire. Speaking then of a group of people who through various means have acquired and maintained an empire, who maintain and exploit control over populations much larger than themselves. We heard a reference here tonight about this population being 5%, the white population here, of the world, and about the total European population being about 10%, yet in control of 80% of the world's economic resources and in control of the other 90% of the world's populations. You're talking about empire then, ladies and gentlemen. And what does that imply? That means then you have a small population that is ruling over populations that are much, much, much larger than it is. And of course, we don't have time to talk about the psychology of this, but I've often indicated that this can only be possible when that small population maintains the larger populations in a state of false consciousness and in a state of deception. That this small population can only maintain control over those larger populations by outright lying and the falsification of reality. But recognize, in essence then, in terms of the problems we are talking about here this evening, the Colin Powells, the black soldiers in the armies, you have to recognize that the essential nature of imperialism is that due to the fact that the imperialist group or nation that runs the empire is so small compared to the empire, it must of necessity recruit from the very population it rules in order to control that empire. When you study the history of imperialism, particularly the history of imperialism as regards African people, which has been going on now for over 2,000 years, when you look at the history of imperialism and colonialism on the African continent, and you study Chancellor Williams' books, and you look at the history of imperialism in Africa, you cannot help but recognize that non-European imperialism and European imperialism has been aided by Africans who were recruited into the armies of the imperialistic masters and were used to practice black upon black violence against their African brothers in the name of their European masters. So then when I talk about black upon black violence in this book, or we talk about the young men and women in the U.S. Army today, recognize then that we are talking about nothing new, but something that is continuous with the very essence and nature of imperialism and racism. Recognize also that when we talk about black on black violence, we are talking about a violence that violence produced. That black upon black violence is reflective of white on black violence. And that ultimately it reflects the violence that this Eurocentric and European community has practiced upon black people and our reactions to that violence. When we then talk about a racist society, an imperialistic society, recognize then that we are talking about a crimogenic society. What do we mean by crimogenic society? Of course, racism is a crime. A crime against humanity and a crime against our race. Imperialism is a crime against our race as well. And therefore, when you have a racist society and an imperialistic society, you have a crimogenic society. What do we mean then by a crimogenic society? Of course, dealing with the word genesis, we are talking about the idea of generating the beginning, as in the word genesis, to begin, the source of, the point of creation of. So when we talk about this society as a crimogenic society, we are talking about this society then as the source of crimes, as the generator of criminality, as the creator of criminals, a society that is run by criminals, and a society then that ultimately criminalizes its population and criminalizes the total system. I had a piece here, you know, there's some of you here who are middle class and you think you're nice. You think you're non-criminal. A criminal society criminalizes all of its constituents. I don't have time tonight to read to you the justification for that piece. Oh, there's some of you who've been in the church and you think you're good. Read in Black on Black Violence, where I talk about your dumb goodness. A goodness that maintains sin and criminality. We don't have time to talk about it tonight. You're in the church, but you're guilty too. Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, when the leadership of a nation lies to that nation, when it deceives that nation, when it miseducates that nation and falsifies facts, it falsifies the consciousness of the people who inhabit that nation. And when it falsifies their consciousness, it recruits those of its people into its criminality. So whether you know it or don't know it, you're a part of the game. Oh, yes, we have to confront our responsibility for this criminal situation as well. Yes, we do. Whether you're looking at us as so-called middle class, remember those of you who are making it in this society, who are making great profits, great accomplishments, sitting at the same tables with your white masters. That you're sitting and profiting from the death and murder and destruction of your ancestors. That as you eat with your white masters, you are eating the flesh and spirits of your people. You can cover it up and lie to yourself and claim it's your individual striving that got you where you're going. That you are taking advantage of opportunities. But remember, these opportunities were based on the death and destruction of African people and the continuing death and destruction of African people. Those of you rolling around in the church and carrying on in the same position as well. But let me continue. This society is a society of criminals, run by criminals, and it is a creator of criminals. And we must recognize it. And I have to say that because we've got some people out here who say, I want my children to be just like them. That's the ultimate goal. I don't want there to be any differences. What are you talking about? You want them to be enslavers, rapists, and robbers, and killers, and murderers, and imperialists, and so forth, just like the other folk, right? Think again, ladies and gentlemen. But due to our time, I'm just going to have to rush through here. I accuse the society of being a crimogenic society, a criminal society. A society that engages in white-on-black violence for a number of reasons. And of course, as you can tell often the psychology of an individual or people in terms of their origins and early childhood experiences, you can look at then the psychology of a people in terms of their origins and early childhood of their race. And when we look then at the origins of this society, we must immediately recognize that it is a society founded on criminal activities. Yes, and that is this inheritance today. It is still a part of it. A society that is a crimogenic society and a society that engages on white, on black violence because it is founded on the murder and theft of Indian peoples and Indian lands. It is a crimogenic society, a criminal society, and a society that practices white on black violence because it is a society founded on the kidnapping of African people, the manslaughter of African people in the mid-passage, the extortion from African people of their labor, and the enslavement of African people. Therefore, the very nature and foundations of this society rest on two massive genocidal crimes, and this original crime is a part of its nature today. It is a crimogenic society because this group of people cannot face their own criminality. They must engage in the psychology of denial and repression and distortion. And this denial and distortion and repression must suffuse throughout the total society, throughout its total institutions, throughout its total values, and therefore ultimately it must pervert its total population. It is a criminal society and a white-on-black violent society because it engages in the crime of breach of contract. It has breached the contract of its constitution. It breached the contracts it made with African people during the reconstructions. It breached its contracts of the 14th, 15th, and other amendments. It breached its contracts in reversing its rulings in the 1860s, 1870s, 1980s, and 1990s. It breached its contract in terms of sharecropping, the peonage of our people, going back on the 40 acres and a mule, and all the rest of the things. It is a criminal society because it constantly engages in assault and battery against its black populations. It engaged in historical lynching, and behind the walls, as my brother mentioned here, of prisons, it still now engages in legal lynchings of African people. It engages in Klan terrorism, which it is still engaged in today. It engages in race riots where it destroys the African people. It engages in police riots, and it engages in police brutality where over 300 or more of our young men and women have been destroyed in the city of New York alone. It is a criminal society, and it is a crimogenic society, and a society that engages in white-on-black violence because it is indicted on the charges of official malfeasance when it revokes its mandate in terms of giving justice to its people and makes this justice system an instrument of injustice, when its so-called rehabilitative system is a school for criminality. It engages in official malfeasance when it rigs its juries, when it legally lynches the ones it so woefully sentences. It engages in official malfeasance when it engages in gerrymandering of black districts, when it betrays the mandates of black voters, when it builds, as my brother mentioned here, prisons as industries so that the incarceration of black men becomes a profit-making industry and a means by which the ruling class makes war against the subordinate classes. It engages in criminal activity, and it is a criminal society when it engages in unfair labor practices, job discrimination, when at the end of the Reconstruction there were more black skilled workers than there were whites, and the whites unionized to keep the blacks from taking advantage of the opportunities that were available to them. It is indicted for labor racketeering when it runs black men away from its construction sites, when we go into a black community where housing is supposedly being made and built for black residents, and we see few, if any, black men building those houses. And when those black men come to work on those sites, they are chased away by the police and the construction workers. And when they are chased away and made to stand on the corners, then they are accused of refusing to work and desiring not to work. We accuse this society of being a crimogenic society, of being a criminal organization, of being an organization that engages in chronic white-on-black violence, when it engages in drug trafficking, when it imports the drugs that poisons our neighborhoods and destroys the consciousness of our people, destroys their health. We see a crimogenic people from way back engaging in the selling of opium to the Chinese and in engaging in opium wars. We see this drug trafficking group of people engaging in alcohol addiction when they used it to destroy Indians, when they used it to destroy African chiefs who, under the influence of the alcohol, often signed away their peoples and their nations. We accuse it of drug addiction and drug trafficking when it traded guns for drugs to carry on its warfare in Central and South America. We accuse it of being a criminal nation, a criminal people, a criminal nation, a crimogenic society, when it engages in gun running across the world, when it sells the very weapons that will be used to destroy its own sons and daughters. We accuse it of criminality when it acts to maintain an evil military-industrial complex. We accuse it of being a criminal society when it sells its death wares across the world. How many of us recognize that we are dealing here with merchants of death? That these people are dead and deadly. People who are robbing black people at home so that they can rob black people abroad. We accuse this nation of being a crimogenic society and the ruling white population of being a criminal people, because they engage in economic extortion, taxation of black people without representation, the redlining of black communities as they steal the savings and investment of black people, as they disinvest in the black community, as they do not return loans to the black community and use the monies that the black communities and the black church place in their coffers to export jobs out of the community into suburbs beyond the black, to the reach of the black population, when they export jobs outside of the country totally and starve our black men and women in Detroit and the other urban centers of this world. We accuse them of economic extortion when they deindustrialize this nation and ship out the blue-collar jobs that maintain the families of black people across this country and ship them to other places and exploit the other populations of this world. We accuse them of imperial criminality and of organized crime. This nation is an organized mafia operation. I have indicated to you that it is best when you look at the international situation that you will come away with a better understanding if you apply the concepts of mafia psychology to the international relations that are going on right now and that have been going on. We don't have time to talk about a chapter I do in here that I call quantifying the myth. You know, the myth of making black people appear to be more criminal than white people. A myth that is statistically supported by the number of black men and women arrested, by the number of black men and women incarcerated, by the number of black men and women under probation and parole. And of course, now we are supposed to look at those statistics and compare them between black and white. And because we see more blacks arrested, more blacks in jail, more blacks in for probation and parole, we are supposed to make the illogical assumption that blacks are more criminal than whites. I told you time and time again, ladies and gentlemen, that in a society that's based on lies, as this one is, in a society that can only exist based on deception, that truth is reversed. That's in essence what a lie is. And therefore, when you look at the so-called statistics that seek to establish the criminality of black people, turn it around and turn them around, and you will recognize that the criminals are outside the prisons. We don't have time to talk about it tonight, but that's the value of having power, you see. You can make criminal whatever you want to make it. You can legitimize your own criminality and perverseness. You can call virtue.
But we want to welcome you to our rally, our unity rally, for a united black front, to unite all factions of our people, to unite every one of the 20 million so-called Negroes into one group. And you'll notice, whenever the white man thinks that we're going to call a rally to knock our own kind, you see him jammed out here. He wants to hear us say something against King or against Bunch or against Farmer, against someone of our own kind. He jams out here. But when you call a rally for black people to unite, let's get together, you don't see too many white folks then. They don't like black people to get together in unity and harmony. As long as you and I are going to attack each other or talk about each other or heat scorn and ridicule upon each other, the white man gets his kick. But when he knows that we're going to come together in unity and harmony, he won't get his kick. He will get kicked. When you see you and I getting together, it is because we have begun to realize that we have a common enemy. And the only time we'll be able to come together with a common objective and a common goal is when we first develop a common motive. And that motive is best developed by recognizing the common enemy. And that common enemy is the white man. I say that common enemy is the white man. The white man is your enemy, whether you are a Baptist, whether you are a Methodist, whether you are a Episcopalian, or whether you're a Muslim, or whether you're a Mason, or whether you're an elf, if you find yourself running into...
We need more linear thinking at this point. Oh, yes. Does that mean that we forget the intuition? Not at all. Does that mean we forget the oral tradition? Not at all. But it means then that while maintaining those traditions, we also must enhance other aspects of our personality. We want to look a bit at culture. What is culture? And we should ask this again. I admire Chancellor Williams very much, and I think the destruction of black civilization, of course, is a magnificent book, and I've said many times, though I think many people read it incorrectly, they read it as history, which it really is not, per se. It is, as he stated very clearly, a set of case studies and analysis of African culture with and of African history with the question in mind, in what way did these cultures or this history advance our interest in as a people, and in what way did this history fail us as a people as well? And we have to look at it that way. What were the problems represented by African cultures such that we permitted ourselves to be overrun by Europeans and we find ourselves in the situation that we find ourselves tonight? Understand? It's no insult for us to ask that question of ourselves. And it's no insult for us to look critically at African history and culture and to be critical of it. It is only through our being critical of our history and our culture that we can advance our interests as a people and survive as a people. Looking at the question, what is culture? Horton and Hunt said from their life experiences, a group develops a set of rules and procedures for meeting their needs. The set of rules and procedures together with a supporting set of ideas and values is called a culture. To a great extent, you see, a culture involves a set of rules and a procedure for meeting needs. And this is the thing we have to keep in mind. You don't have a culture just to have a culture. And you don't claim a culture just because it's a culture or just because it's African. The ultimate thing that culture must do is solve problems. That's why people evolve a culture. That's why a culture comes into existence as a way of what? Solving problems and meeting needs. That's why, at a certain point, when a culture no longer meets the needs of a people or solves the problem confronting a people, that culture must be transformed. There's nothing sacred about holding a culture in the face of, you know, new events and new changes. Unless, of course, you are free to do that if you're willing also to accept suicide or death. And you have that right to that choice. You know, I tell people, you know, we have the right to say, look, we're going to hold on to this culture even if it kills us. But we should be what? Very conscious of our decision. We should not be holding on to it out of a misunderstanding of what culture is supposed to do. Ultimately, culture is supposed to solve problems and to meet the needs of the people. And a culture then has to be measured against those standards. Does this culture meet our needs? Does it solve our problems? Chancellor Williams, in a sense, then looked at the African cultures, looked at African characteristics, and looked at them in terms of in what way did they meet our needs and in what way did they deal with the slave trade and colonialism and the other kind of things that happened to us as African people. And after going through that, then he set up what? The plan, which a lot of people don't read. Which is the whole point of what? It's the whole point of the book. Not the first part, but really the second part. Looking at our culture and our history critically, he then, and looking at our situation and where we are today as a result of that history and of those cultures, he then draws out a map for a plan, a way for us to what? Get out of our situation and to restore African civilization and to restore African people. But it's at that point most people sort of move on to something else. Mm-mm. This is the place you must study. We're going to include that in our power studies, by the way. that plan along with some others. The sets and rules and procedures together with a supporting set of ideas. Cultures are not just ways people sing and dance and what they eat and how they dress and the rituals and so forth that they perform. These ways of behaving and dressing and so forth are based on sets of ideas and values. And ultimately, in a deeper sense, it's this set of ideals and values that lay the basis for culture. Kluckhorn and anthropologists indicated that culture and he defined culture as all the historically created designs for living, explicit and implicit, rational, irrational, and non-rational, which may exist at any given time as potential guides for the behavior of man, for the behavior of the people. In other words, culture creates designs as a result of its history for living and provides guides for its members, guides for behaving. As a set of guides for designing, for guiding the behavior of its members, a culture provides standards of proper cognitive, emotional, and behavioral conduct. Culture provides a set of norms and concepts of what is to be expected to exist, why we expect them to exist. Though culture is a product of actual experience, culture is essentially ideological, meaning that it essentially exists in the mind, because culture ultimately is based on the sharing of beliefs and customs and expectations. We receive our culture as a result of, as a part of our social heritage. To the degree that the individual identifies or is at one with this culture, and to the degree to which the members of a culture identify with it, culture is represented in the minds of its people. In other words, we have to recognize deeply that culture cannot exist outside of ourselves. It only can exist in our minds and in our bodies as a people. And therefore, to a great extent, it is ideological more than it is physical, more than it is behavioral, more than it is just ways of dressing. Ultimately, a culture must be represented in the very minds of a people. And it is only through its representation as a mental entity that a people can identify with the culture. A culture is a way of thinking, a way of attending the world, of perceiving the world, of classifying and categorizing the world, of ordering the world, of processing information, and of evaluating the world. When we say then that the Europeans decultured us or distorted our culture, we are also saying then that the Europeans have distorted our modes of attending the world, our modes of experiencing the world, our modes of classifying and categorizing the world, our modes of processing information that comes from the world. So there's no little wonder then that we are having problems in what some people call education, particularly as it is European, Eurocentrically designed, that our children are perceived as having problems in thinking skills and math skills and science skills and so forth. Because ultimately, you see, culture provides you with a frame for thinking. It provides you with a structure for organizing information, for classifying information, for evaluating information, you see, for processing information. And when you distort a people's culture, then you distort their capacity to appropriately organize information and deal with it. And this is what has happened to us. This is the reason why I say again and again that the problem of education in terms of the problems our children have in schools are not education problems. They are political. They only express themselves as educational problems. The problems our children may have in paying attention, thinking so-called logically, categorizing, classifying, in terms of vocabulary and so forth, are really not academic problems. They are cultural problems, and they are the result of political interactions. Because in transforming our sense of who we are and what we are, and in transforming our culture, so was our thinking and so forth transformed as well. This is why ultimately the educational problems of our people will have to be solved in terms of cultural transformation, not just in terms of educational technique, you see. And this is what the whites try to lay on us. You know, we're going to discover finally that great reading technique. Children can learn almost in any way you teach them. But it's about more than technique. It must be a part of a total cultural structure. And the children must come with a cultural intentionality, because no technique is going to matter if they pay no mind, if they have no interest, you see, if their culture has given them little or no reason for learning what is to be taught, if what they're learning is really not relevant to their situation and their circumstances. And so we have to understand very much how culture itself structures the thought processes. Now, there are some of you who are saying, but there are those of us who knew nothing about African culture and we got all A's in school and so forth and so on. Remember this, though. We got these A's in school and we went through these schools at the price of alienation. As the gentleman who's Carter G. Woodson wrote, about the fact that it took him, 30 years to get over that Eurocentric education? What is he talking about? To a degree, without that African-centeredness, without that African sense of culture, without an African-centered intentionality that determined why he was learning and for what reason he was learning and how he was going to use his learning in the interests of African people, he adopted an alien culture, as many educated blacks have had to do. In adopting the alien culture and adopting the alien outlook and adopting alien values and so forth, they adopted then a thought framework, you see, that allowed so-called what? Success within the European academic system, you see. But the unfortunate thing about it is, once you adopt that structure and that mode and orientation of thinking, you can only work within it. And so you can keep your ability to think abstractly and logically and scientifically only if you work for us as a what? As a scientist. But you cannot take that thought and what? Outside of that structure and use it in your own interest. And this is the dilemma that many of those who so-called succeeded in this system have had to face. You see, I categorize in terms of European structures, and I find that I'm only comfortable in what? Working within those structures. And I can only what? Advance those structures. The European system has this economic system set up in such a way that when you try to use this structured kind of thought outside of the system, it won't pay you. Yeah, it will punish you. And often your own group has problems with it, because our group only pays preachers. But it would rarely pay anyone else that tries to operate in its interest. And so you get caught up in two worlds. Socially, culture patterns the ways in which its members relate to each other, interact with each other, perceive each other, and the ways they organize, develop, institutionalize, and apply their human potential in order to adapt to the conditions in which they live to satisfy psychological and social survival needs. Ultimately, as I said again and again, culture is about solving problems. But we're going to learn, as I've indicated before, solving problems in a cultural way, creating power in a cultural way, requires relating to each other in a particular sort of way, implies interacting with each other in a particular sort of way and perceiving each other in a particular sort of way. I've indicated under other circumstances that individuals do not have power. Power is the result of the nature of social relations between people. The way people choose to interact with each other makes power. If you don't believe it, you can go back a few years and see how little white boys could order grown black men around. Were they big enough to beat them? Were they big enough? Did they have enough power to knock them down? No, they didn't. But it was because those little white kids were in a, what, structured framework and had behind them, what, a set of structures and strategies that because white people had chosen to relate to each other in a particular way and interact with each other in a particular way and interact with us in a particular way, even a white child could come out and express power over black folk. But the power was not what? Inherent in the child. But it was inherent in the culture and inherent in how that culture was designed and structured. And it's out of this, and this is what I've told you before about an economic system. An economic system is not the mere existence of money. Economic systems existed prior to money. Money as an instrument of economy has come late in the history of man. And yet we've had economies for hundreds and thousands of years before money came into existence. So ultimately then, an economy must have something to do with the way people choose to cooperate with each other and relate to each other. It is out of this that an economy develops, and it's out of this that power develops, you see. So if you have a culture, the culture is going to provide patterns of relating and interacting. It's these patterns of relating and interacting that permits a people who belong to a culture to solve the problems that confront them. So you see, again, it's just not something is to just indicate that you wear, you see, or the speech that you make, you see. It ultimately has to be about relating in a particular structured sort of way. This is what culture is socially. It is very important to keep in mind that a culture is, to a significant extent, a historical product. Let's talk a second about identity. Identity is the social and personal outcome of the or product of an identification process. According to Bandura, this identification process is a process in which new responses are acquired and existing repertoires of behaviors are modified to some extent as a result of subjection to direct or indirect conditioning procedures. All cultures condition the people that belong to them. All cultures ultimately must have some means of rewarding and punishing behavior. And that's another thing we don't want to face, you know. We want everybody to do right just because it means doing right. And this is what I said earlier when we talk about these conspiracies and these boulets. You're not going to win this game if you don't have a means of neutralizing people and rewarding people, you see, and controlling people. The reason why, as I've often said, the very first thing that we must do if we are to transform our children is to get control of them. Yes. And we must become their primary rewarders and punishers. We must determine the conditions under which they are socialized if we want to create the kinds of people we need to solve our problems. You are not going to solve your problems giving the control of your children over to other people. And yet we sit around here hoping every day, after pushing our children and ourselves into the faces of white folk, into the faces of our enemies, that these people, by luck or some means, will happen to be the kind of people we need for ourselves. The very point and process of education is to create the people you need for your benefit. And if a culture is going to educate your children, it then will educate them to benefit whom? Itself. Not you. Not you. You must bring your children under your own control. And you must be in control of the conditioning process. This is what it's about. If you don't have control of that, then really you're not going to have control of the children. Because identification with a culture, becoming cultured or enculturated, is the result of a culture approving and disapproving, of rewarding and not rewarding, and of sometimes even punishing, to ultimately shape the individual in a way that it benefits the culture and ultimately the individual, him or herself. And this is what identity is about. It's about patterning, the patterning of thoughts, feelings, and actions after other persons who serve as models. You even learn to love. You know, we think that love is something natural, just flows out of us automatically. And yet we have a number of cultures who did not base marriage and these other things, as I've told you before, on romantic love. Mm-mm. Even romantic love is taught and learned. Yeah. Yeah. People are taught how to feel. And we do it all the time. You shouldn't feel that way. You should feel ashamed of yourself for thinking this way, for behaving this way. And we're so unconscious, we don't even recognize it, you see. But we are doing what? We are dictating what? Feelings, thoughts, emotions. What is love in the name of their European masters? So then when I talk about black upon black violence in this book, or we talk about the young men and women in the U.S. Army today, recognize then that we are talking about nothing new, but something that is continuous with the very essence and nature of imperialism and racism. Recognize also that when we talk about black-on-black violence, we are talking about a violence that violence produced. That black-upon-black violence is reflective of white-on-black violence. And that ultimately it reflects the violence that this Eurocentric and European community has practiced upon black people and our reactions to that violence. When we then talk about a racist society, an imperialistic society, recognize then that we are talking about a crimogenic society. What do we mean by crimogenic society? Of course, racism is a crime against humanity and a crime against our race. Imperialism is a crime against our race as well. And therefore, when you have a racist society and an imperialistic society, you have a crimogenic society. What do we mean then by a crimogenic society? Of course, dealing with the word genesis, we are talking about the idea of generating the beginning, as in the word genesis, to begin, the source of, the point of creation of. So when we talk about this society as a crimogenic society, we are talking about this society then as the source of crimes, as the generator of criminality, as the creator of criminals, a society that is run by criminals, and a society then that ultimately criminalizes its population and criminalizes the total system. I had a piece here, you know, there's some of you here who are middle class and you think you're nice. You think you're non-criminal. A criminal society criminalizes all of its constituents. I don't have time tonight to read to you the justification for that piece. Oh, there's some of you who've been in the church and you think you're good. Read in black on black violence where I talk about your dumb goodness. A goodness that maintains sin and criminality. We don't have time to talk about it tonight. You're in the church, but you're guilty too. Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, when the leadership of a nation lies to that nation, when it deceives that nation, when it miseducates that nation and falsifies facts, it falsifies the consciousness of the people who inhabit that nation. And when it falsifies their consciousness, it recruits those of its people into its criminality. So whether you know it or don't know it, you're a part of the game. Oh yes, we have to confront our responsibility for this criminal situation as well. Yes, we do. Whether you're looking at us as so-called middle class, remember those of you who are making it in this society, who are making great profits, great accomplishments, sitting at the same tables with your white masters. That you're sitting and profiting from the death and murder and destruction of your ancestors. That as you eat with your white masters, you are eating the flesh and spirits of your people. You can cover it up and lie to yourself and claim it's your individual striving that got you where you're going. That you are taking advantage of opportunities. But remember, these opportunities were based on the death and destruction of African people and the continuing death and destruction of African people. Those of you rolling around in the church and carrying on in the same position as well. But let me continue. This society is a society of criminals, run by criminals, and it is a creator of criminals. And we must recognize it. And I have to say that because we got some people out here who say, I want my children to be just like them. That's the ultimate goal. I don't want there to be any differences. What are you talking about? You want them to be enslavers, rapists and robbers and killers and murderers and imperialists and so forth, just like the other folk, right? Think again, ladies and gentlemen. But due to our time, I'm just going to have to rush through here. I accuse the society of being a crimogenic society, a criminal society. A society that engages in white on black violence for a number of reasons. And of course, as you can tell, often the psychology of an individual or people in terms of their origins and early childhood experiences, you can look at then the psychology of a people in terms of their origins and early childhood of their race. And when we look then at the origins of this society, we must immediately recognize that it is a society founded on criminal activities. Yes, and that is its inheritance today. It is still a part of it. A society that is a crimogenic society, and a society that engages on white, on black violence because it is founded on the murder and theft of Indian peoples and Indian lands. It is a crimogenic society, a criminal society, and a society that practices white on black violence because it is a society founded on the kidnapping of African people, the manslaughter of African people in the mid-passage, the extortion from African people of their labor, and the enslavement of African people. Therefore, the very nature and foundations of this society rest on two massive genocidal crimes, and this original crime is a part of its nature today. It is a cremogenic society because this group of people cannot face their own criminality. They must engage in the psychology of denial and repression and distortion. And this denial and distortion and repression must suffuse throughout the total society, throughout its total institutions, throughout its total values, and therefore ultimately it must pervert its total population. It is a criminal society and a white-on-black violent society because it engages in the crime of breach of contract. It has breached the contract of its constitution. It breached the contracts it made with African people during the reconstructions. It breached its contracts with the 14th, 15th, and other amendments. It breached its contracts in reversing its rulings in the 1860s, 1870s, 1980s, and 1990s. It breached its contracts in terms of sharecropping, the peonage of our people, going back on the 40 acres and a mule, and all the rest of the things. It is a criminal society because it constantly engages in the assault and battery against its black populations. It engaged in historical lynching, and behind the walls, as my brother mentioned here, of prisons, it still now engages in legal lynchings of African people. It engages in Klan terrorism, which it is still engaged in today. It engages in race riots, where it destroys the African people. It engages in police riots, and it engages in police brutality, where over 300 or more of our young men and women have been destroyed in the city of New York alone. It is a criminal society, and it is a crimogenic society, and a society that engages in white-on-black violence because it is indicted on the charges of official malfeasance when it revokes its mandate in terms of giving justice to its people and makes its justice system an instrument of injustice, when its so-called rehabilitative system is a school for criminality. It engages in official malfeasance when it rigs its juries, when it legally lynches the ones it so woefully sentences. It engages in official malfeasance when it engages in gerrymandering of black districts, when it betrays the mandates of black voters, when it builds, as my brother mentioned here, prisons as industries so that the incarceration of black men becomes a profit-making industry and a means by which the ruling class makes war against the subordinate classes. It engages in criminal activity, and it is a criminal society when it engages in unfair labor practices, job discrimination, when at the end of the Reconstruction there were more black skilled workers than there were whites, and the whites unionized to keep the blacks from taking advantage of the opportunities that were available to them. It is indicted for labor racketeering when it runs black men away from its construction sites, when we go into a black community where housing is supposedly being made and built for black residents, and we see few, if any, black men building those houses, and when those black men come to work on those sites, they are chased away by the police and the construction workers. And when they are chased away and made to stand on the corners, then they are accused of refusing to work and desiring not to work. Mm-hmm. We accuse this society of being a crimogenic society, of being a criminal organization, of being an organization that engages in chronic white-on-black violence, when it engages in drug trafficking, when it imports the drugs that poisons our neighborhoods and destroys the consciousness of our people, destroys their health. We see a criminogenic people from way back engaging in the selling of opium to the Chinese and in engaging in opium wars. We see this drug trafficking group of people engaging in alcohol addiction when they used it to destroy Indians, when they used it to destroy African chiefs who under the influence of the alcohol often signed away their peoples and their nations. We accuse it of drug addiction and drug trafficking when it traded guns for drugs to carry on its warfare in Central and South America. We accuse it of being a criminal nation, a criminal people, a criminal nation, a crimogenic society, when it engages in gun running across the world, when it sells the very weapons that will be used to destroy its own sons and daughters. We accuse it of criminality when it acts to maintain an evil military-industrial complex. We accuse it of being a criminal society when it sells its death wares across the world. How many of us recognize that we are dealing here with merchants of death? That these people are dead and deadly. People who are robbing black people at home so that they can rob black people abroad. We accuse this nation of being a crimogenic society and the ruling white population of being a criminal people because they engage in economic extortion, taxation of black people without representation, the redlining of black communities as they steal the savings and investment of black people, as they disinvest in the black community, as they do not return loans to the black community and use the monies that the black communities and the black church place in their coffers to export jobs out of the community into suburbs beyond the black, to the reach of the black population. When they export jobs outside of the country totally and starve our black men and women in Detroit and the other urban centers of this world, we accuse them of economic extortion when they deindustrialize this nation and ship out the blue-collar jobs that maintain the families of black people across this country and ship them to other places and exploit the other populations of this world. We accuse them of imperial criminality and of organized crime. This nation is an organized mafia operation. I have indicated to you that it is best when you look at the international situation that you will come away with a better understanding if you apply the concepts of mafia psychology to the international relations that are going on right now and that have been going on. We don't have time to talk about a chapter I do in here that I call quantifying the myth. You know, the myth of making black people appear to be more criminal than white people. A myth that is statistically supported by the number of black men and women arrested, by the number of black men and women incarcerated, by the number of black men and women under probation and parole. And of course now we are supposed to look at those statistics and compare them between black and white. And because we see more blacks arrested, more blacks in jail, more blacks in for probation and parole, we are supposed to make the illogical assumption that blacks are more criminal than whites. I told you time and time again, ladies and gentlemen, that in a society that's based on lies, as this one is, in a society that can only exist based on deception, that truth is reversed. That's in essence what a lie is. And therefore, when you look at the so-called statistics that seek to establish the criminality of black people, turn it around and turn them around, and you will recognize that the criminals are outside the prisons. We don't have time to talk about it tonight, but that's the value of having power, you see. You can make criminal whatever you want to make it. You can legitimize your own criminality and perverseness. You can call virtue a crime and arrest people for being virtuous. And then you can look at the statistics and say, aren't they more criminal because they are in jail? Some of you read the recent situation here in the Hasidic community where a bunch of Jews ran out, broke arms, and hurt the police. What, about 2 or 3 dozen policemen? This, of course, comes after a time when they broke into a police precinct station and ransacked it. How many of those people went to jail? How many got fingerprinted? How many of them are in prison? And so forth. And yet, can we say that they did not commit a crime? You see, what do we have here then? A situation, you see, where if you use crime statistics, you're not going to find those Hasidic Jews in the statistics. You're not going to find them on the prison rolls. You see, that's what power does for you, isn't it? It permits you to commit a crime and keep yourself out of jail. And then you can go into the jailhouse and look at the statistics and compare the number of blacks arrested on probation, on parole, and compare them with Hasidic Jews. And say, well, I see one is very big and the other one is very little. Therefore, the blacks must be more criminal than the Hasidic Jews. You can never be more wrong in your life. You have to understand, but we have to get away from that. You know, and this is the kind of teaching that goes on in the university today. Understand that when white boys and white girls are not on the rolls, the prison rolls, and in the prison populations, it points to the efficiency of their criminal organization. How do we say that? A mafia don who has a very efficient criminal operation, who can create a murder incorporated, who can engage in drug trafficking and killing and murdering and extortion, the same kind of games I've been reading to you here tonight, can earn so much money until he can keep his children innocent, keep them out of jail, give them good educations, and the whole bit. You understand what I'm getting at? In other words, those children's names do not appear on the crime blotters. They are not in the jails because their fathers are such good mafia operators. So even their innocence speaks to the efficient criminality of their fathers. And because then the white boys are not in jail with the black boys, do not make the assumption that means the white boys are less criminal or their fathers are less criminal. It means they just have a criminally efficient operation. We got to move on here. This country then is an imperialist criminal operation because it robs the people at home And you see it as it robs the people abroad. It constricts the black males to fight its criminal wars. It maintains worldwide terror and extortion. It, of course, maintains the criminality in Namibia, South Africa, Angola, Panama, Grenada, Central South America, Zaire, and the whole bit. I accuse this nation of being a criminal nation because it engages in the health neglect of our people. This nation, as determined by its own task force, indicates that black and minority health, in the area of black and minority health, there are 60,000 more minority deaths per year based on an expectation of equal death rates for blacks and whites. As a matter of fact, melanin gives you an added lifespan. So what are we saying here? That this society, due to its neglect of the health of black people, excesses the lives of some 60,000 black people a year. This is murder. It engages in child neglect and child abuse as it maintains the infant mortality rate of black children to more than twice that of white children, as it maintains a measles rate 16 times that of white children, as it maintains the poverty of our black children, increasing the poverty of black children at the rate of some 750,000 children a year. It engages in educational neglect, as it engages in the miseducation of our children, as it refuses to fund the Head Start and early childhood education programs, as it refuses to fund the education programs under Chapter 1. And I wish I had the time to read the statistics here of how our children are killed and our families are destroyed through educational neglect. This criminal society then sets up the psychology of black-on-black violence by creating a sense of powerlessness in our young people, by projecting negative stereotypes upon their mentality, such that they seek to escape an African identity and alienate themselves from their African selves and internalize the values and perceptions projected by the dominant society, as their appetites are distorted so that they literally then eat themselves to death or desire things which will destroy them, as it frustrates them such that in their anger they turn against themselves, as it makes them displace their anger against their fellow victims. This society is a criminogenic society because it serves as the best model of criminality. The black-on-black criminal has learned from the best of teachers, the white-on-black criminal. It engages in criminality as it supplies weaponry to our children and alcohol and drugs. How does this relate then to our adolescents? Recognize that almost 50% of the young men who die between 15 and 24 die as a result of homicide, black-on-black homicide. This would be a major health problem if we were another ethnic group. Recognize that the cream of the African race is being destroyed before it has a chance to reach manhood. Homicide is the leading cause of death of black males between 15 and 24. Is it because, ladies and gentlemen, if you look at the demographic situations in this country, we are producing and outproducing white people in terms of children? Must understand that at a rate of almost 3 or 4 to 1. The Hispanics are outproducing them about 5 or 6 to 1. That means the larger part of the up-and-coming population is going to be black and Latino. And these people have already written about the birth dearth. And so what do we have here then, ladies and gentlemen? The destruction of a race and the destruction of that group that would move us toward being a majority in this country. So this has a lot to do with adolescence. And adolescence, of course, is a major point in the development of an individual's life, because it is during adolescence that the self-concept is being developed, that the individual is undergoing an identity crisis, a gender identity crisis, that the individual is dealing with the issues of self-esteem, dealing with the issues of body image, which is the reason why you see them getting caught up in clothes and other adornments. It is the period of time when an individual looks for social affirmation and social acceptance and looks forward to social belongingness. It is a period of time when the emotions are labile and unstable, and therefore the individual is seeking to bring his emotional, sexual, and other drives under control. It is a period of time when the individual is wrestling with social acceptance, wrestling with alienation from the adult society, the society in general, and alienation from itself. It is the time when the person is engaged in intellectual development. It is a time when the individual is asking and trying to deal with moral questions and make vocational choices. It is a time of egocentrism, a time of status striving and being concerned with clothing and cars and other things. It is a time when the person deals with invidious comparisons. That is, how do I make myself look good by making other people look bad? And therefore, when you look at this social system, it strikes our youngsters at their most vulnerable periods of their lives and seeks to transform them. Now, you may say, some of you who are older, well, you know, we wrestled with the same thing. But keep this in mind, you see, that though these issues are issues that may have been a part of my generation and earlier generations, that these issues are taking place within a different social political context. They're taking place within a different socioeconomic historical context. And it is these contexts that combine to determine whether these issues will develop into positive outcomes, negative outcomes, or conflicting and ambivalent outcomes. So today's black adolescents, particularly the poverty-stricken adolescent, exist in a world that is quite different from the world of his parents. Very different from the world even of the 50s and 60s, because we have a youth now that is engaged in the post-industrial age. When you dropped out of school, there were jobs waiting in some factory or on some shipyard or some other place for you. Those jobs are not there today. And so you have to recognize that these youngsters are dealing with a different world. The computers weren't there when you dropped out at the time and when you miseducated yourself. These are children who are engaged in an information age. These are children who are engaged in a highly urbanized world. These are no longer farm boys and rural people from the rural South caught up in their rural communities. These are kids raised in the ghettos, in the projects, and in the poverty-stricken areas of the urban cities. These are children then that are raised in an information data processing world, a world of television and mass media, a mass media that recognizes that they have money or that they can get money, and now a world that instead of just selling to adults makes teenagers its major marketing audience and therefore creates desires and wishes and plays the
black bodies. They took unusual black bodies and they displayed them in a propagandized context. So if you took a very short man and you surgically implanted horns in his head, and you told him not to speak, and you gave him a manufactured identity, he would appear in the circus. Circuses were run by physicians sometimes. He would appear in the circus and be described as not someone who I own, who I made to do this, but this is a typical inhabitant of an obscure African land. Many of them can't speak. And there was also a very strong tendency to look at Africans of short stature and compare them to animals, to apes. On the right, The man standing there with the monkey grasping his knees is named Otobenga, and he was displayed in the Bronx Zoo in New York City in 1909. Not in 1600s, not the 1700s, it was just a century or so ago. Displayed in the Bronx Zoo, at that time, Darwin's theory of evolution was still being hotly contested. And he was displayed as a very powerful, popular argument that here are people who represent the boundary between man and animal. He was put in the zoo with an orangutan in the cage. His cage was littered with bones. And so people who might not read Darwin, who might not be scientifically literate, people who are just sort of, you know, common and interested in popular things, they could be convinced by this. Without picking up Darwin, they could be convinced by this. So this was a very, very important underpinning and part of research with African Americans. The most disturbing and ugly side of study of African American body came from anatomical dissection. And interestingly, it happened very all through the country, mostly in the South at the beginning, but then it spread. And what would happen is that during the 18th and 19th centuries, people felt differently about dead bodies than we do today. People usually died at home, and the body was cared for in a way that was very ritualistic and bound the person to his family and society. You would bathe the body, you dress them in special clothes, you take photographs that you passed around to your family and friends. It was very important to have this bonding ritual. And for that reason, doctors weren't allowed to dissect bodies. The only bodies doctors could dissect were the bodies of criminals, especially heinous criminals, who died under a double sentence of execution and dissection. So that left doctors in a dilemma. Medicine was beginning to evolve, and the Paris School, or the idea that doctors should be familiar with the body, was evolving. They needed bodies to study, and yet the law wouldn't give them any. So where did they turn? They turned to black cemeteries. They turned to black hospitals. They turned to charity wards filled with black patients. And a lot of black people believe they also turned to the streets. I have talked to more Baltimoreans than I would care to tell you who have explained to me that within recent memory, you didn't walk around Johns Hopkins late at night. Now, I'm going to confess to you that the first time I heard that, I thought, I'm not sure I buy that one. But I had to listen when I heard it from one young man who was very fervent about it. And when I talked to him a bit longer, I found out that he was the son of Henrietta Lacks. Henrietta Lacks was a young black woman who in 1951 died, but not before scientists at Johns Hopkins took samples of her cell without her husband's permission. And these cell samples allowed them to found the line of cell line culture. Because of her cells, polio, there was a cure found for polio within a year. Because of her cells, there have been countless medical innovations, new medications tested and inscribed. Her cells have been probably more valuable to American medicine than the contribution of any other person. And yet, many people don't even know who she is. So when her son told me that, of course, I had to respect it and pay attention. And although usually, in fact, almost always, people will disparage accounts of, you know, there being night doctors who actually took people and killed them and used their bodies, I did turn up one fully documented case, of a Baltimore woman who was indeed killed for her body, and her body was then sold to anatomists. That's such a common thing, by the way. It's not that it's a rare occurrence. It's such a common thing that there's even a name for it. It's called Birking. It's called Birking after the criminal who in England did so many of them that he was eventually caught and hanged for it. So this woman was a white woman, but she lived among black people and had a black boyfriend. And she was killed, and her body was sold to the anatomy department. So there's no evidence of anybody else, but if you think about it, it just might reflect the social realities of Baltimore during that time. What we do know for sure is that the bodies of black criminals, but not white criminals, were likely to be given to anatomists. We do know for sure that doctors as part of their training, sort of a rite of passage, had to learn to go to cemeteries and exhume bodies. Later, they became more specialized, and the procurement of bodies was left to porters, the people who were bought by hospitals to clean the floors. And they shared this duty. Their job was to go to the black cemetery and exhume bodies. Grandison Harris is probably the best known one. He was a porter at the Medical College of Georgia. And that was his job. We know this because in 1995, construction workers who were renovating the Medical College of Georgia's old laboratory, when they broke into the basement, they found almost 10,000 human bones. 75% of them were for African Americans. People in the Augusta, Georgia area, black people had been complaining for centuries that doctors were taking bodies from the black cemetery. And now, in 1995, it couldn't be denied any longer. And what happened to the Medical College of Georgia actually played out across the country. Most hospitals who had access to a black cemetery were getting their bodies there. And this actually is very well documented in the book. It's not anything that's actually contested. Part of the reason it's not contested is that the physicians themselves were very open about it. If you look at the books in which they write the provenance of the bodies, they were careful to say, we got them from the black cemetery, because they didn't want white people afraid of them, and they didn't want white people rebelling. Also, there was the first black professor of anatomy, Montague Cobb, made a study of it in the Cleveland area, where he found out that at the beginning they had used white bodies, but over time, Cleveland, Ohio, medical schools were using black bodies from the South. So there was a real commerce in shipping black bodies north, often in barrels that were labeled turpentine. And it's, you know, just a horrible thing, but this was real commerce. One other thing I wanted to point out before I leave this rather gruesome subject is that the image in the center is that of a lynched man. When I look at lynched bodies, I'm often reminded of the bodies such as those on the left, which are hard to see, I think, in this image, I'm sorry, but they're cadavers lying on tables. These are black cadavers lying on tables at the Medical College of Georgia. And what's interesting is that if you look at the men in the anatomical dissection photograph, they're looking right at the camera. They're well-dressed. They're wearing ties and shirts and vests. This is because these photographs were sort of a class portrait, sort of a rite of passage for medical students. When you look at the photos of lynching scenes, you see the same thing. You see well-dressed white people looking very unself-consciously at the camera, sometimes very jubilantly, and the bodies were disposed of similarly. Medical students would take souvenirs from
the
bodies.
Not true, that it just stays in the injection. So people are beginning to put two and two together, and some people are calling what's going on World War III. Well, I certainly don't know about that, but I do know that everything about COVID-19 has the word weaponization written all over it. Even on mainstream media, I mean, they were roasting Anthony Fauci and other people in the NIH. They funded the gain of research, the gain of function research that was going on in China. They're trying to blame China, but they paid for it. Maybe China did the work, but they paid for it. So blame them both. They were both involved. Let me find a couple of more headlines here that I think. Yeah, here we go. Now the funeral directors. The funeral directors around the country are speaking out. And what they're saying is that the only people who are dying from the vaccine. People are not dying from a virus anymore. They're dying because they took the vaccine. Now, here's Pfizer and Moderna COVID-19 injection hijack your cell's ribosomes and churn out toxic proteins that attack your body. Okay, well, here's an article that I'm looking at. That just goes into the details of what I was talking about just a few minutes ago. These injections hijack your cell's ribosomes. Those are the little machines inside your cells and make protein. They're like printers. you put the program in the lab, it's all going to print out a protein, just like the printer in your office. So you print out enough of these toxic proteins, and you're sick. They attack your body. Get yourself. Now, here's an interesting headline from England. Apparently, three BBC presenters, newscasters, three BBC presenters dead from the vaccine. A guy named Dom Busby, 53 years old, suddenly developed a brain tumor, dead 11 weeks after he took the AstraZeneca pill shot. And the same thing is going on in the airline industry. British Airways has lost four pilots in the last week. Vaccine death. American airline companies, they're having the same problem, and they're starting to cancel flights. And they do report they have a pilot shortage, but they don't say why they're short on pilots. But it's easy to understand that when you're flying to 30 to 40,000 feet, anything that has a tendency to cause a blood clot is going to be more deadly at 30,000 feet than it would be at sea level. Not only that, if you're at 30,000 feet, 40,000 feet, you're exposed to all kinds of cosmic radiation coming in from outer space, all of which is a deadly combination. So pilots, flight attendants, and people who do a lot of air travel, you're putting yourself at great risk, especially if you have been vaccinated. Now, here's an interesting story about the same topic. You know that in